The following program has been furnished and paid for by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSCB and KGBC are not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And we're glad you could join in with us today. And as usual, let's remember that just because you hear something that sounds like it might benefit you, either whether it's a tax strategy or perhaps an investment opportunity, please check with your existing investors or advisors, I'm sorry, first, and let's let them make sure that you're not diving into the deep end without enough water in that pool. In any event, for those of you that may not have advisors that consult on private real estate partnerships and zero tax math strategies and assorted other ways to improve cash flow using real estate, feel welcome to go to our website at beaplanner.com. And if you'll go to the forms link, you'll see on that page several forms that if you would just do the first step, the first number one form, client profile, that would give us enough information to discuss with you how or if we might be able to help you should you choose to step into the world of private real estate partnership syndications. As you know, if you listen to the show, that area of real estate investment, for me at least, and I know others feel this way, is the low-hanging fruit, if you will, in the real estate arena. And I'm not going to argue the case of those that think that single-family properties might be better. They're different. That's how I would say it. It's kind of like the Mac and Windows argument as to which one might be better. It varies from person to person. And all I would say is, for some of you, you're probably more suited to own and manage single family than you are to simply invest as a passive investor where you're trusting someone. It all boils down to trust, plus cash flow, net operating income to be specific. But without trust, you're not going to find it plausible to hand somebody $50,000 to $100,000 of your hard-earned savings, maybe your retirement money, if you do what I recommend, and trust them to bring that transaction to a level of cash flow that you know, best utilizes that asset and at the same time creates distributable cash flows out to the partners. In any event, again, if you want to have a discussion with me, fill out that first form, the client profile at beaplanner.com, and then click the forms link at the top right. And once you've done that, the next step is to go set a time for a phone call, which you'll see at the rightmost link, a call link, and you can pick your time that you would like to have that call with me. You know, I was watching some of the goings on yesterday, I believe it was, in the news, and I saw the proclamation that Mr. Trump mentioned, and I want to talk about Trump for a few minutes here before we get started, you know, because you're not going to hear the good news necessarily out of the media or the mainstream media, and even the articles that I'm looking at are from the, I'm going to call them bipartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget site. It's at crfb.org, and if you've listened to the show before, you know that I refer to this group from time to time because I've got some pretty smart economists working for them, and I like the way they break down the effects of assorted legislation. I trust them a lot more than I would trust the CBO or the Congressional Budget Office, which at times I think they forget they're supposed to be an impartial umpire. But in any event, the proclamation yesterday was the 90th birthday for Social Security since it came about. I believe it was 1935, if I recall correctly. And the current status is that by the time it hits 97, according to the latest estimates by the chief actuary of the Social Security Trust Fund, it will be insolvent. And there is a possibility it might be combined with the disability trust fund. And if so, that adds another 3 years. It's when it would turn 100, the reserves would be fully depleted. And that's presuming a set of assumptions that may or may not play out. But the 7 years, the point would be late 2032, and at the moment, and this could shift slightly, I've seen assorted articles over the last 3 or 4 years that say that the above or across the board cut that will occur statutorily, it's already part of the Social Security statutes, will be anywhere from 23% to 25% if nothing's done to turn the card around. And 24% is what is the number that the CRFB uses in this article. Again, crfb.org is where you can read the details. But let me just pull a couple of key points here. A typical couple retiring just after its insolvency status kicks in will face a $18,400 cut in annual benefits. Now, that obviously means they're both getting somewhere in the $60,000 to $70,000 range for that 24%. To work out to that. Recent legislation, particularly the OBBBA, that would be the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, but also the Social Security Fairness Act, has accelerated insolvency alongside well-known demographic challenges. Trust fund solutions are needed soon, very soon, I would suggest, to prevent insolvency and the statutorily required benefit cut. And, you know, it may not sound like a lot of money to those of us that are, you know, using real estate to effectively fund retirement, but, you know, nobody likes to get less than what they thought they bargained for. And, you know, every statistic you look at on Social Security, except the cost of administering it, are going down in terms of its ability to sustain the current rate of benefit payments. Under the current law, the Social Security program cannot pay out more in benefits than it has collected in revenue. So, you know, as a result of that, all current new retired beneficiaries, regardless of their age, is going to get hit with the 24% cut after the retirement trust fund is depleted. You know, there's several solutions, and I'm not going to get into solutions today. We'll save that for another show soon. But if you want to kind of get out in front of this, I would suggest you go to YouTube and search for videos by the GOP Arizona, well, Arizona GOP representative, David Swikert. And he's got copious charts and diagrams that show the sad state of affairs, both for this component of the overall federal budget, as well as Medicare and others, and then just in general, the U.S. budget. Of course, it's in bad shape, too. It's just with that particular creation, we'll continue to borrow and effectively print money as long as other countries are going to let us. And the problem is, it's like a double-barreled gun where one barrel's pointing north and one's pointing south, if you will. And their economies are going to be as probably as badly or worse even affected if the U.S. were to default. So it's going to be interesting. Congress has kind of been pushed into a corner, but what I'm going to say, and the reason I'm suggesting you go check out the videos by David Swikert, is he's got some recommendations that are pretty commonsensical, I think you'd agree, and don't involve throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, they really make sense and might work, probably would work. I think that, you know, they deserve, you know, discussion. And who knows, maybe, you know, Mr. Trump will find a way to put the brakes on some of the spending that's a part of the most recent, the OBBBA, that increases our deficit somewhere between 5 and 7 trillion, I believe, was the final configuration over the next 10 years or so. But, you know, when you look at what's happened with Social Security from the recent past, it's years of neglect from Congress that's caused Social Security, it's caused it to rapidly decline as fast as it has. You know, the 75-year shortfall has grown to almost 4% of taxable payroll. That's up from 3.5% of payroll in 2024, 2.8% in 2019, and 1.9% back in 2010. So there, it's a like a snowball rolling downhill. And relative to the economy, the 75-year shortfall has grown by 0.6. It's less than 1% of GDP in 2010 to 1.4% today. So, you know, roughly, what, 2.5 times? So, in any event, it's, you know, we can keep kicking the ball down the road for at least 7 years, I suppose, but there's going to be a problem. And the other problem is that this isn't the only thing that's going to push our economy into a steep decline. We've got the overall budget. We're within a shorter period, probably 2008 or 9, to where we will have spent the last remaining piece of the discretionary portion of the annual federal budget, which is the part we argue about every year as to how it gets spent. Well, there'll be no more arguing 2028 or 2029 unless we do something, again, to turn the ship around on the extent of the deficit. It will be a point where we cannot pay 100% of the interest on the annual debt that we have, $37 trillion or so now, the part that we admit to. It's much higher, but you can go back and listen to last week's episode where I talked about the U.S. debt clock at usdebtclock.org, and they show the unfunded mandates that will eventually be moving into the current year budgetary cycle, and it's over $100 trillion, and that's an incredible number when you look at almost any metric associated therewith. And the thing that's even more scary is that we're on a track to continue to have a $2.1 trillion additional deficit each year, $2.1 trillion each year that's getting added to that. And so there's no easy way out. It's either, you know, raise taxes or spend less, which, boy, that would be amazing if people in Congress would think that away. But, you know, there are some other issues that are still percolating, maybe more than percolating. The same organization, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at CRFB.org, has an article from earlier this week about the tariffs. It says tariffs are generating meaningful new revenue. Have you read that in the Houston Chronicle? I'm just curious. I don't recall seeing anything about that, but in any event, let's see how much. And by the way, there's a section added to the usdebtclock.org site. It's a treasure trove of information, but it's down, I think, towards the bottom of the left side. I don't have that site up in front of me. But get this. This is the tariffs. Now, it hadn't been that long since I remember everybody in the media talking about how there's no way these tariffs weren't going to put us under. They were going to hurt us. We're really paying them. We citizens. And I thought at the time, I sure hope Trump's right because, you know, this one, you know, you can view it with fear and trepidation if you've got some common sense, because we've never done what we're doing right now. I mean, this is new territory. Collectively across the board. I mean, have we done tariffs before? Of course we have. And it's interesting that, you know, of all the complainers, you know, the Biden administration complained loudly about how Trump's tariffs weren't going to work, and yet, you know, Trump had put tariffs in place on China, our trade with China, back during his first administration, that were still in place when the Biden administration came to power. And they didn't cancel any of them that I'm aware of. I've heard that mentioned several times. So they must have realized, oh, that extra, I don't know how many billion it was, it's probably a couple hundred billion. If I remember right, they appreciated having that. But in any event, assuming the tariffs remain in place, these and a variety of previously implemented tariffs, including a 10% baseline reciprocal tariff and recently announced trade agreements, are likely to generate significant revenue. These funds could be used for deficit reduction, not new tax cuts, spending, or rebates. And those who wish to reduce or reverse the tariffs should put forward alternative sources of deficit reduction to replace them. And, you know, if you look at what they're suggesting here, I'm just going to skim and pull out a few numbers. The new tariffs introduced by the current Trump administration will generate an estimated $1.3 trillion of net new revenue through the end of his term, and $2.8 trillion through 2034 before accounting for economic effects, about $600 billion more than the tariffs in effect as of May. Now, when you think about it, that's a significant source of funds to cut that annual $2 trillion deficit. I'm pretty certain that that source of revenue is not included in the CBO's report, because they had this number. They've been touting this number since January. It was part of their revised 10-year report that they do every year. But, you know, $2.8 trillion through, I guess it'd be the period of 2028 to 2020 or 2034, plus $1.3 trillion between now and 2028, the end of Trump's term. That's a lot of money, and that absolutely will stymie some of this excess spending. Although, you know, the problem, as I see it, is Congress will spend it. They won't let it go to take out existing spending. They're going to spend more. Mark my words, that's what you're going to see. But in any event, more importantly, depending on the legal outcome, you know, there is some question about, there's a several cases, I believe, in the U.S. trade courts that is saying that, hey, these tariffs are illegal. They shouldn't apply to us, whoever us is. And that if the ruling, if rulings are made favorable to such parties, it could raise as little as $800 billion through 2034. We'll take it. I mean, $800 billion, what's a few billion amongst friends, right? But more importantly, depending on the legal outcome, recent tariff increases will generate somewhere between 0.2 to 0.8 of 1% of GDP of net new revenue through 2034 using conventional scoring. So it's material, and you know, it's something that we have to do. I mean, I don't know, where are you going to come up with another 2.8 trillion a year? Show me that. But in any event, and there's a discussion of the history of tariffs. Since 1940, tariffs have generated only a small amount of revenue for the federal government. Prior to the first Trump administration, for example, tariffs were generating about $3 billion per month, largely due to tariffs put in place during that administration, including on Chinese goods and steel and aluminum. Monthly tariff revenue grew to about $7 billion per month in the year prior to this administration. Since then, revenue has expanded dramatically. So it's a roaring success despite the silence of the mainstream media, and we need to hit on a few more cylinders, like monetizing the Anwar oil reserves and selling off some of the 14,000 empty office buildings that the U.S. Owns. But in any event, well, let's go ahead and take our first break. We're halfway through the show, and I will circle back here momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
Grindstones and rhinestones are made of my life. Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-782-1900. That's 713-782-1900. Or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com. That's Nathan at npross.com.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Is it easy? No, it ain't. Can I fix it? No, I can't. Well, I sure ain't gonna take it lying down. Will I make it? Maybe so. Will I give up? Oh, no. I'll be fighting till I'm 6 feet underground. I'm gonna woman up and take it like a man. I'm gonna buckle up, be tough enough to take control and make the
okay, welcome back to more of this week's Be A Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA. I just had a couple more comments about the Social Security debacle. You know, the New York Times really frustrates me at assorted moments in times. And they had an article about this Social Security 90th birthday approaching. Let's see, when was this? It was earlier this week, the 13th. And it's amazing. I mean, you know they've got some smart people, and you would think they would take advantage of all the significant resources out there, like the CRFB and the significant research machine that they operate. But anyway, let me just call out a couple things they say. They have alleged myths. They've got, let's see, how many myths does this article point out? Let's see, we're up to 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 myths. So I'm going to just run through a couple of these right away. One of them is that it's the baby boomers, us baby boomers, that are causing the problem. I think I'm in the last year, or maybe it expired right before me. I'm a 1960 baby. But the reality, well, let's see. I guess I jumped ahead. That's myth number two. Myth number one is Social Security is running out of money. That's the New York Times. Running out of money. Oh, and they're saying that's a myth. Really? Though the New York Times describes the claim that Social Security is running out as a myth, it rightly points out that Social Security has been drawing down the program's reserves, that's a quote-unquote, drawing down the program's reserves, as costs continue to exceed revenue. By 2032, the trust fund for the retirement program, that's the Old Age and Survivor Insurance, or acronym OASI, you may have heard of, will be empty. Its reserves will have, quote, run out. At that point, the law calls for benefit payments to be limited to incoming revenues. This is the 24% issue we discussed earlier, which means a 24% across the board cut to all beneficiaries, the equivalent of about $18,000 in annual benefits for a dual earner retiring couple in that year. Okay, so the myth. The fact is that there is no myth here. Let me make sure I didn't leave off. No, that's okay. So that's the fact is that there's no myth here. The program's trust fund is on course to depletion, and policymakers will need to affirmatively act to avoid this large, abrupt benefit cut in just 7 years. Alleged myth number two, this is the one I mistakenly jumped ahead on. Aging baby boomers are the problem. Fact, Social Security shortfall is driven mainly by population aging. About 60 million seniors collect Social Security benefits today, up from less than 50 million a decade ago. 40 million in 2000, the year 2000, and 30 million in the year 1980. Those over 65 now represent 18% of the population, compared to about 11% in 1980. And with over 10,000 Americans retiring every day, 10,000 more people retire, the Social Security rolls will continue to grow. This is like Medicare. 12,800 people, I believe, are added to the Medicare rolls every day. I believe that number is still valid. I know it was up until a year or so ago. And that one's equally scary, although that one tends to grow, I think, faster because of the significant increase in medical cost. And all of us know an elderly person, if it's not us, right? And I can tell you, I've got clients that have proved or unfortunately had to demonstrate this point. They didn't volunteer. But, you know, and I myself, I didn't have a Medicare incident simply because I wasn't on it yet. But, you know, you can rack up a $500,000 bill in a very short amount of time in the U.S. medical system. And even if you're only responsible for 20%, it's still a life event, no matter how you slice it. And I know I've had clients that have had, you know, back situations, heart, cancer, etc. And, you know, if you figure out, you know, out of the, again, let's call it 60 million possible people. I don't know. I don't have the Medicare numbers in front of me. Let's just assume all the Social Security, the current seniors that are collecting Social Security, the 60 million, just had one incident, or let's say 10% of them just had one incident that was, you know, $1 million or so. That's a significant dent in the system. And if it's just 1 or 2% each year, and that's, you know, keeps happening, which I think the numbers are pretty clear that it does, it's just a huge increase as medical costs go up. And, you know, part of the problem, and I'm assuming this article is going to point this out as well, is that the system, let's see, I was looking real quick to see if they discussed the medical cost increase. Well, let's jump to the next myth. Myth number three, Social Security helps drive the deficit. Fact, Social Security is currently adding to the unified budget deficit and may add much more in the future. So that's basically saying it's worse than the myth. The myth is it's not that big a component. I can tell you right now, again, look at the usdebtclock.org, and it has the four largest components of the U.S. Annual budget, and you'll notice that Social Security is, it's either the largest, it's in the number one slot, but the way that that site shows Medicare, they combine Medicare and Medicaid, so that component takes the number one spot. If it wasn't for that, if they broke them apart, Social Security would be in the number one slot, and it's annually, I believe, like close to 1.7 trillion, if I recall, from the discussion we had a week ago. And so the increase, the annual increase, is not going away anytime soon. And if you look historically at the rate of increase, the amount over the annual revenue for Social Security, between 1990 and 2010, Social Security's revenue exceeded its cost by $1.1 trillion. Since then, costs have exceeded revenue by a combined $1.4 trillion. I'll say that again. Between 1990 and 2010, revenues exceeded cost by $1.1 trillion. Since then, cost have exceeded revenues by a combined $1.4 trillion, adding to deficits. It no longer reduces the overall budget deficit. This year, Social Security's cash imbalance will add a projected $250 billion to the deficit. So, let's see. I'm going to skip a couple of these myths. Alleged myth number five, we need to cut benefits now to pay them later. Fact, acting now with thoughtful benefit and revenue reforms is the best way to ensure benefits can be paid in full. Under the current law, Social Security beneficiaries face a 24% across the board benefit cut in just 7 years. Avoiding this cut will require closing Social Security's imbalance, which remains reducing its cost, i.e. the benefit payments, increasing its dedicated revenue, or some combination of the two. You know, I think what this points out, and I'm just going to go ahead and I don't see this on the myths and the facts. The problem we've got at base is that we've got too few people paying into the system, the Social Security system, and too many claimants or beneficiaries taking payments currently. And that increases. You know, the baby boomer period has really put that number at a huge imbalance. And if you step back in time, back in the 30s, when Social Security came about, there was approximately, I believe it was between 10 and 11 people, workers, 10 or 11 working folks that were effectively supporting every recipient of Social Security benefit payments. So it was like, let's just call it a 10-to-1 ratio. Now it's virtually the flip side of that. It's one and a half to two workers supporting each beneficiary. And that's the problem. And so, you know, we come back around and say, well, how do we change that? Well, declining birth rates isn't the way to change that, and that's what's happening. And our immigration policy is, you know, a bit distorted right now because we're focused on illegal immigration, and I'm against illegal immigration, but I'm also recognizing that there are some good immigrants. You know it, I know it, we've eaten at restaurants, we've stayed in hotels where people want to be here in America. And a lot of them, in fact, I'm going to suggest the large majority are not gang members, and they're not murderers, etc. They're good, hardworking people. And I know I stayed at a hotel across from the office there on Westheimer in Houston for a couple months back 2 years ago when I came over to visit the U.S. and got to know some of the Cuban staff that, you know, had immigrated and were working at that hotel. And I was chatting with them one day, and I asked, well, how did y'all get here? You know, what spurred you to come to America? And they said, well, we wanted to work, and Cuba didn't have jobs that paid, you know, as much as the U.S. I mean, we're talking about housekeeping staff, basically. And I said, well, how did you physically get here? And they said, well, we took a boat from Cuba to, I guess, Florida, somewhere on the East Coast, and then we walked across. I said, come again? We walked across Mexico to get here. And I just marveled, and I told him, I said, well, there's not many Americans that would go to that much trouble. Let's face it, we're a lazy people, to come get a job. I mean, it just goes to show you the rest of the world does not have our, I'm going to call it luxury. You may disagree. Maybe it's not luxury. It is in large measure when your circumstances are different. I see it here. As many of you know, I live in Thailand, and, you know, we can go to many places outside of Bangkok and realize that, you know, the overall per capita income here is probably up from the level that I recall when I first visited here back in 2006. If you're talking about the northeastern province, the Isan province, which is where my wife grew up and many other people, it's the biggest province around. I remember seeing an article then that the average per capita income was about 1500 US per year. Now that's gone up, as has the cost of living, but you know, people think differently when that's their lifeline in terms of being able to provide food and shelter for their family. And you know, I'm not going to suggest I want to live with that budgetary constraint, but it makes you realize many places around the world, when they're looking at that housekeeping job at a hotel in Houston, Texas, and they see what they can make there, that's a huge incentive to do whatever it takes to get here. And again, somehow we've got to find a way to find those immigrants and get them integrated into the U.S. payroll system, because that is the only, I think, the only good way that we can turn this ship around. Because raising the amount of the annual Social Security and Medicare cap, well, Medicare cap is already 100% of whatever you make gets taxed. You can raise the rate, but you know, Social Security is capped way up at, I think it's $171,000 this year. It boggles the mind as to how it's gone from, I mean, I remember when I first came out of U of H working at Arthur Anderson, it may have been as high as somewhere in the 20s, maybe not that high. And I just shake my head, and you realize most people have no idea the overhead that an employer is incurring to pay just the FICA and Medicare half that they have to fund. Forget about health insurance, you know, your family's health insurance. I see W-2 after W-2 every year doing tax returns. It's 25 to 30 grand a year to get family coverage. And that might be on the low side. I don't know the details of those plans. All I see is what the employer paid. But in any event, it's crazy. Okay, let's pivot. I've got about 10 minutes left here. I wanted to point out, you know, now that there's more and more syndications coming back out, you may be comparing one or two or four to determine which one to invest in. And I wanted to make you aware of a tool that I've had for a while now out online. I haven't really promoted it, but it's a very simplistic tool that anyone can utilize if they're trying to assess which of multiple options should I consider investing in. And this tool is at one of my sites, P, P ppmmath.com. Again, PP, like private placement memorandum, math, it's abbreviated, .com. So ppmmath.com, and it's called The Equalizer is the tool that's on that site. And if you look at it from the home page, you'll see menus down the left side, and you'll see The Equalizer. Well, first of all, I've got a discussion about the basics of looking at private placement memorandums, and I don't have time to go into this on today's show, but this is a good brief discussion for those of you that haven't joined, or even if you have joined a mentor slash investor platform. This cuts through to the essence of what you need to look at on competing private placements and will help you not be dissuaded, perhaps, or persuaded to join a syndication that, you know, it's really tilted, the information you get is tilted by either the mentor platform or the syndicators involved. Just push all that to the side and just remember, just the math. Just the math is what we care about. But anyway, if you go to the Equalizer menu choice, you're going to see that very simplistic, you only need three data elements, net operating income, and all these, by the way, are going to be in the PPM. If you'll get to the financial pro forma information, you're going to see the NOI at some spot on that financial depiction. And then you need to understand how much equity is being put into the transaction. That'd be the capital that's being raised. And then you want to know the amount of the leverage, the loans. How much are we borrowing that the partnership will be utilizing? Mortgage loans, sponsor advances, you know, lead partner advances, which you may not see much, although these days with the debt structures challenges that we have, you're going to see that. But that probably wouldn't be anticipated on the front end. But there did nothing to say you can't put some numbers in on your own and say, well, hey, I think based on what I'm seeing, these syndicators may end up having to add $500,000 at some point. What does it look like if I do that? What if we run into those kind of headwinds? But in any event, the amount of the debt that we want to capture is any amount, it's all debt for which the partnership is going to be responsible for repayment. And so anyway, with those three variables, and again, this is so simple, but you know, if anybody wants some help on this kind of analysis, they'll need to engage. But I've walked through this in my sleep with clients at times. I guess I should say literally, because I'm usually asleep when y'all are up and working there in America, 12-hour difference and such. But the formula is take the NOI, divide that by the present value of all cash contributions plus the principal amount of all outstanding debt. And you want to do this for the first full year of ownership. So on that pro forma, that's likely going to be year two. I mean, it's very unusual, or let me say it's not unusual. It's not the norm, however, that you purchase a property, you know, the first week of January. So you might push to year two to use the numbers, the NOI, at that point. And so when you make that calculation, that is what I'm calling the equalizer, that result. And it is a current year yield measure. You're measuring the current yield. Think of it as the cap rate of the property figured or computed at the partnership level. The higher the equalizer or current yield, the better the deal. And it's very important. You'll see a note on that area of the web page. The equalizer does not predict the rate of return on investment. over time, the cash flow, the appreciation, in some cases tax benefits, must all be considered to calculate the rate of return. That's not what we're trying to decide here. We're trying to decide what's the likelihood we're going to get our money back. That's really what this measure is designed to capture. And again, if you're just doing one transaction, this may still have some relevance. If you've invested in other transactions already, go run it for the ones you invested in and then see how the performance has been based on what the equalizer would have shown had you done it in advance before you invested. So let's see, I'd read about this is not the calculate the rate of return. That said, the equalizer is an easy method to compare partnership purchase prices at the time you're considering alternative real estate investment opportunities. And I'll tell you, this simple little tool has given a lot of clarity to folks as they're struggling over, because, you know, the syndications, they're all a bunch of shiny objects. You know, when the syndicator puts out the PPM and everything's going to be hunky-dory and, you know, we're expecting big things out of this deal. And that isn't to say that the equalizer is going to flush out which ones are not going to be successful, but it's going to flush out which ones you're paying more for per dollar of yield than the others. So it's a very important criteria as you look at your alternatives. I think we're here close to the end of the show. Once again, I want to just thank you for tuning in today. And we're going to be back with more on Sunday. I think it'll be a normal Be a Planner show. It will not be the cyber show. I think Mr. AI Wynn is dealing with parent medical conditions, etc. But in any event, we look forward to having you, and it'll be right here on KSEV AM 700 and KGBC AM 1540. Once again, thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Ooh.